tonight on Arena. Lady Gregory's retelling of the Dermot and Grainne saga comes to the Abbey stage, and we have live music from Holly Munro. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Dermot and Grainne is one of the great love stories in Irish mythology. She, the beautiful daughter of the High King of Ireland. He, the famous young warrior of the Fianna. But Grainne is betrothed to Fionn MacCool. And when the young lovers run away together on the eve of that wedding, all three individuals will pay a heavy price. Lady Gregory's play, Grainne, has just opened at the Abbey Theatre, directed by its artistic director, Katrina McLaughlin. Ella Lily Highland plays the eponymous Grainne, with Niall Wright as Dermot and Lorcan Cranach as Finn. Delighted that Katrina McLaughlin and Lorcan Cranach are with me in studio right now. Katrina, this has been the year of the Gregory Project. She ran the Abbey Theatre, and there she was with this great play of hers that never saw the light of day.
No.
Was that what attracted you to it?
Do you know what? To be 100% honest, I programmed it before I knew that actually it hadn't been on in the Abbey. I think it's a beautiful play, and there are very few plays that deal with relationships so well. I think it's a brilliant play about relationships. And I read it during COVID with Melissa Shearer and Caroline Byrne. We started reading all Lady Gregory's plays on Zoom, and it just really stood out.
So it chose you rather than you kind of saying, yeah, you know, I'll choose that particular one. But this is part of the Gregory Project. How much do you think Irish theatre and international theatre owes Lady Gregory? Because we always think of Yeats.
Yeah.
She's kind of Anne Gregory, Lady Gregory, as a kind of an addendum.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what made us do the Gregory Project. I mean, she is the person who is the first to write in the vernacular, if you like. She was the person who tried to find the voice of kind of local people in Galway, tried to find an English version of the Irish language. Hmm. She is the forerunner of Sing, of O'Casey, in my view, of anyone who has written in the vernacular since Marina Carr, Conor McPherson, whoever. Marco Rowe, all those people, I feel, who write in the voice, in the voice of their place and in a kind of Anglo Irish English or...
Yeah, Hiberno-English kind. Yeah, that is certainly what is there. But Lorcan, you play the character of Fionn MacCool, or Finn, as he's simply referred to in this text. And I was struck reading sections of it. There are times when the language is... very stylized, very high flown.
Yeah.
But yet when I was watching you play it on Saturday night, it was as if you were speaking regular language, the vernacular, as Katrina talked about.
Well, I take that as a compliment, Sean, because I think that is part of the challenge is, yes, it is the vernacular, and the sentences are as long as they are. And part of one of the traits of that is that there are probably more words used that are actually needed to convey whatever you're actually trying to say, and we become very used to short sentences in this, you know, nowadays. And so, I think, yeah, that part of the challenge is to know more than you might have to with Shakespeare. Sometimes, you know, you just choose your inflection carefully, and it's extraordinary how conversational the thing can become once you're familiar enough with it.
Yeah, and add to that it's Fionn MacCool. So, you know, it's major hero that you're playing here.
I think a hero with
a few flaws, it has to be said.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't look at him like that at all. I suppose I think that is one of the great things about the play. I mean, it is... It's quite modern in that sense. Mm. I mean, in terms of the relationships within it, it is, you know, it's an original love triangle, which is, you know, happens in every piece of storytelling, drama, music, anything like that. It's a very sort of original idea, and that's why I think it has a an immediacy about it, why it's got an accessibility about it. And for me, I think that's what attracted me to the idea of playing it, because it's not, you know, you can't play a myth, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Or a hero.
Well, the world needs to see my Finn McCool at this stage, but I think what is good about it is what's really attractive about it is the fact that it is, you know, it's they're real people, and you know what I mean. That's the way I think into it.
How does Lady Gregory or Augusta Gregory achieve that in the script, do you think, Katrina? Because obviously it spoke to you, I presume, in some similar way when you read it.
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean, I think she wrote the humanity, the characters in the situation that they're in. And I think, you know, it's fair to say she had some experience of this, like...
Very nicely put.
Yeah. This situation.
Should just explain what her situation was and how it feeds directly into Dermot Agus Gráinne and Finn.
Yeah, well... She was married to a man 35 years older than her, and we now know that a couple of years into her marriage, she met Wilfred Blunt, who was a poet and activist. They met in India, and they had an affair, a very passionate affair, and she wrote a series of sonnets, which was then subsequently published by Blunt without her name attached to them under a woman's sonnets. And those sonnets actually were used in the music in the play, because to me, the experience of her own lived experience and how she writes in those sonnets can be seen really clearly in the play.
So you brought those sonnets into the production, and we have music provided within the production as well. What do you think that music brings? Not just in terms of, obviously, it makes the show more entertaining, it makes it more dramatic that we have music and speech, but does it bring some other aspect to things? I'm thinking particularly in contemporary terms.
I think it does. And I think that we are more familiar with poetic ideas and poetic language through music at the moment. But I think in terms of the play and in terms of what she's writing about is very, very smart, and it's articulated really brilliantly. But you need a little bit of space to hear it and to let it land. And I think something that the music achieves really well is gives the audience a little bit of space to reflect on what they've just seen and heard, and a little bit of, I suppose, time to reflect on their own experience of the various things being discussed.
We're just looking at the programme there for the two vocalists that you have on stage, Sean Boylan and Laura Sheeran, and the music and the entire sound design is that of Carl Kennedy. What does it add for you, Lorcan? Because in some ways, your character is in repose while he's travelling, because Dermot Agus Gráinne are travelling around, and you're following them around. Finn is following them around as well. Does that music offer something to you, you know, outside of the action as an actor?
I think what's there's a sort of, Carl has created apart from the actual main melodies, there's a soundscape which has been introduced, which we can experience ourselves while we're on stage, and it is really, really it's a great sort of foundation for what's going on in the, and it's very beautifully read and composed for the particular scene that is going on, and so it's very supportive of what we're doing, actually.
And, you know, we talk about lovely music and we talk about heroes, and there is some villainous behaviour, it has to be said as well, a lot of it on the part of Finn. I think we could argue. Do you see him as a villain?
I see him as a slightly confused man. He has come through his own different relationships in his life, and he has a chance of, you know, the greatest relationship he ever has. Yeah. But it's also, he's aware of the fact that she is going to be, that this is a big step for her, and if he could mess it up for her life as well. Yeah. So he's concerned about. I actually think,
and he also has a very strong relationship with Dearman.
He does. Yeah, yeah. Who was who he has brought up as his son.
Yeah.
And it's an extremely close, and it's a very, very strange moment where in Dearman's death, where he expresses his love for him in a way, and there is like Grainne and Finn are actually vying for Dearman's love right at the moment of his death.
At the end,
it's a very, very. Curious situation.
Now, you're saying typical man, Katrina.
Yeah.
How typical a woman then is Grainne?
Oh, I hope she's totally typical, but unfortunately, I doubt it. She's very willful and knows her mind and knows her body, knows what she wants and goes after it. No?
Yes. No.
Yeah, and it's been really, you know, it's been really fascinating seeing that as something written by Lady Gregory over 100 years ago.
Yeah, because I have, just to quote four words from the top of the press release, love, lust, power, desire. I mean, it isn't high-flown nobility that's in question here.
Absolutely not. You know, it's not. And what's really interesting about it is, even though the language is very poetic and very, you know, in the realm of romantic or higher love, play is utterly earthy and utterly, you know, of the body.
Yeah, and you do that very well in terms of particularly the second act of the play, where it's very sensual relationship between Dearmuid agus Grainne. And I suppose when we all read and learned Tóraíoch Dearmuid agus Grainne or Dearmuid agus Grainne at school, I don't remember quite that level of sensuality being explained to us.
Do you know what? It's funny you say that, because there's a lot of water in the production. Mm. And one of the things I remember doing it at school too, and I remember reading this part of it, which was basically saying they're running through Ireland and Grainne runs through a puddle and a little bit of water splashes on the inside of her leg. And she turns and says, Dearmuid, that water is braver than you are and you're the third best man of the Fianna. And funny, that is the thing that stuck with me from Tóraíoch Dearmuid agus Grainne. I thought it was a really kind of interesting, well, obviously, you know, being a teenager, something struck me about that. And I think that was really important to me in delivering that idea in the production.
By which he means, is it that, you know, the water is brave enough to touch my leg? You won't go anywhere near it. But he's been noble, but he's fulfilling his promise, Dearmuid is, by not going near her.
His promise to Finn for 7 years. He's a better man than I, let's put it like that.
There's a get-out clause. Katrina, obviously, we're coming out of a period when the theatre was dark for a large portion of the summer. Why was the Abbey not in business essentially for those months?
Well, I think it was in business. I mean, the doors were closed to our audiences, but to be honest, we were as busy as ever, and in some ways more busy. We had a number of workshops in development for new plays that are scheduled for next year and the year after. But I suppose the point you're asking is, why did we not have audiences in for those 6 weeks?
Well, they're kind of an essential part of the theatre too, aren't they?
Of course they are. Of course they are. So every year we have maintenance. We have a couple of weeks in January. We've a couple of weeks in the summer, and that's their compulsory maintenance that we have to have. This year, we also had to include critical maintenance. We had an issue with our rig and with our fire iron. And
that's the big curtain that people will see coming down at the beginning, which has to be raised and lowered for fire safety reasons every night.
Yeah. And we're not allowed anyone in the building if there's an issue with the fire iron, for example.
Could you not? Was there no facility? Because obviously, I'm sure you must have felt, August, this is the period when we can put on a really good, strong, well-known piece from the canon. We can get the crowds in, we can get the tourists in, we can continue to enhance that reputation abroad of the theatre, and we can get some money in.
Yeah.
Could it have waited to November? Well, when things are traditionally quite quiet.
Well, November's not really quiet. And strangely enough, January is our best month. And August isn't a brilliant month for us because we don't get the same sort of tourists that you normally get in August. Like July is much better for us. But I was hoping to do a much bigger production for the Dublin Theatre Festival, which we've scheduled for next year.
Is that the Marina Carr play?
It is, yeah. So that was in the schedule, which meant it had a bigger tech period. So that was already in the schedule based on our Arts Council application last year. So when we came into the beginning of the year and we were making decisions based on our actual budget as opposed to our fantasy budget or our, fantasy, but you know, you put in an aspirational budget. We decided to move the boy, as it's a massive undertaking, into 25, but that meant that slot was there. So we'd already greenlit a number of productions for the beginning of the year. We had to do the maintenance. We had to do the critical maintenance. So it made sense when the slot was there to do it.
So you had moved the boy, the Marina Carr play, you'd moved that into 2025.
Yeah.
Were there any financial considerations? I mean, was the entire Arts Council grant at your disposal? Because I know there was a hold up on that for periods of time because of the delayed publication of sections, not all of the Crowe report. Did financial considerations, financial, you know, constraints come into play?
Well, I mean, the Abbey Theatre, like all theatre at the moment, is underfunded. So we have 8.5 million for 24. Last year, for example, we had 9.5 million because we had reserves from COVID. The year before, we had 9.5 million. So our operating budget was less than it had been for since I came in. So of course that had an impact, and that's why we revised the programme, and that's why we moved things around. But insofar as if, you know, the Arts Council holding back money, no. The Arts Council deliver money at certain points in the year, so it had no impact on that decision.
The Crowe report then, Katrina, was published in part back on September the 17th. How is morale among the staff in the Abbey?
Do you know what? I think we all understand that to have a review of processes and procedures at any point is actually quite a positive thing, insofar as we have a really good, highly functioning organisation now. I think the staff understand and appreciate the point we're in now. And actually, we had it felt really like we were drawing a line under any question marks that had gone on before. And it feels like a really positive move, actually. So morale is really good at the moment. I mean, we've two great shows on in the building at the moment. We've got Gráinne, we've got Safe House, which is Enda Walsh's play.
Yeah, himself. So Animal Archie were in with us last week.
And we've a number of things in development. So the place is buzzing and everybody seems very positive at the moment.
What comes in after Gráinne? I know Jean Lorcan doesn't want to think about what happens after Gráinne. that's the end of the run. What are we getting after that?
We have an incredibly exciting new production and a first-time director on the main stage in the Abbey, Claire O'Reilly. But we're doing a big, bold, fun, contemporary version of Emma.
So is this a new version of it? Is this a big cast? Is this a big production that will give lots of employment to actors over the Christmas period, which they will want for sure?
Well, I think we always go for as big a cast as we can achieve. It's a medium cast, I would say, but it's a big
team. What kind of numbers do you know?
Eight.
And would you like to have more? Would you like to spend more on the cast, or why have you held it at that? You know, you're not directing.
Well, I loved the production. I thought this year we had a number of more sort of serious, more reflective pieces, and it felt like a good moment for us to have a joyous and celebratory piece. And this piece I've been looking at for a while, and it just felt like a great timing for it. Yeah, I suppose that's why, really, more than anything. It's a great play at the right time and a bit of fun and a laugh for Christmas. And we wanted to bring as many people back in as possible, obviously because we were closed for those 6 weeks. So we do want to bring people back in and celebrate and have them enjoy coming to the theatre at Christmas and have a party, really.
Well, that's the next production, but we should tell them about the current production. Lauren will want us to do that. Thank you both for coming in, Lauren Cranley. And Katrina McLaughlin and Gráinne, directed by Katrina and starring Lorcan, alongside, as I said, Niall Wright and Ella Lily Highland, and our musicians Sean Boylan and Laura Sheeran. It's running at the Abbey Theatre through until the end of the month, October the 26th, and you can get full details on abbeytheatre.ie.
Dublin-based songwriter Holly Munro blends electronic elements and folk pop in her music. She collaborates with the producer Luke Potashnik at Wool Hall Studios in Somerset, once owned by Tears for Fears. She also happens to be the sister of duo Hudson Taylor. Holly will be a featured artist at Ireland Music Week, but delighted that she's with me in studio now, along with her pal, Brendan McGlynn, and she's going to perform a song from her second EP. That second EP is called A Crescendo Ending, and the song is called Out of Style.
I meant to tell you something wasn't right. You meant to tell me that you're not ready to fight. But hope got ahead of us, so we didn't try. I just can't get the moment out of my mind. Our love is out of fashion, our words are out of style. I still remember clearly how I used to make you smile. I still remember clearly how I used to make you smile.
Holly Munro there with her song Out of Style from her second EP, A Crescendo Ending. Sad old ending to that to that song, Holly.
Yeah, it's a little bit sad, but there's a lot of love in there too. It's a song like a relationship breakdown song, so it's maybe one of the heavier ones I have, but It's still a lot of love in there.
But I believe it is from the current, from the crescendo ending.
Exactly,
it
yeah.
It is your favourite song on that EP?
It is, yeah.
Why I think, so?
I think mainly for the production of it. It just kind of came together and sounds exactly how I imagined it would sound in my head when I wrote it. Because I write all my songs just me and guitar, so bring them into the studio is kind of a different experience.
The EP has a fuller feel to it, but I must say when you pair it back to the two guitars like you just had with your Brendan obviously playing guitar as well and doing harmony vocals there, I suppose if a song doesn't stand up in that fashion, doesn't matter what bells and whistles you put on it on an EP.
That's true. But,
noticeable that you've said about Out of Style, because obviously is about the breakup of a relationship. Our love is out of fashion, our love is out of style. I remember when I used to make you smile, if I'm not changing the lyrics slightly, but that's the general gist of it. You say that it was your own experience plus the experience of a friend. Is this a special friend now that you have as a useful decoy in front of you?
No, I think actually it was more because a lot of the time all my songs would be very, very personal. Mm. And this was a slightly different approach to writing because I was more thinking or reflecting on somebody else, a close friend's relationship. And then like taking bits of my own experience and then kind of planting it in to what I would view is happening in the relationship, if you get me.
Yeah, but that's interesting that, you know, because you had such a positive response to the first EP, Up Against Your Nature, which was very personal type of songs within that, that the addition of a friend, of a second person who might be fictional or who might be a real person, I suppose, doesn't matter that much, but that allowed you to go somewhere different with the music, right, with the songwriting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I suppose I try not to think about it too much when I'm actually writing.
Yeah.
But it was one of the first times that I actually have taken it a bit outside of myself, and it actually makes it a bit easier sometimes to sing.
I guess so.
Because it's less like hand on heart, you know.
Yeah, not. Here's another awful sad story from my life. You know, there's something else in there. Tell me about working with Luke Potashnik then at Wool Hall Studios in Somerset. I mean, Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
And also Luke has worked with big people along the way.
He has, yeah. So I started working with Luke when I was about 18 years old. I released my own EP on SoundCloud and he ended up listening to it, and then we met up for coffee and did one song, and then just over the years I've kind of always returned to working with him. He used to be based in London in a little studio in his house, and now he's in this new studio in Wool Hall. An insane place there, just very, the whole vibe of the building, it's kind of a church, and just you know that like Joni Mitchell has played there, and it just it's very electric.
Yeah, that when you walk into somewhere that has that type of history to it, how freeing is that, or how frightening is it in some ways as well?
I don't even know. It's just a bit mad. Like you can see on the like some of the plug boards still say like Tears for Fears on it. You know, sometimes when I've been singing songs, I've been thinking about all the other people who have also been singing songs in this room, maybe coming from the same place or a different place. So
yeah,
very lucky to work out of there.
So Luke possibly has become the third brother, because there is the duo Hudson Taylor, who are the two brothers. What about growing up in a musical family? Like, obviously there was a lot going on. Did you collaborate, or did you play around musically much with your brothers?
Yeah, I mean, they've always been such a big support to me. I'm really encouraged writing. Like, I started when I was about 16, and it was Alfie in particular. Like, I sat down one day and played him this really dramatic song on the piano that now is one of the first things I ever wrote. And when I hear it, I'm like, this is very dramatic. A lot of teenage angst. But he was like saying it's amazing, and, you know, giving me a lot of, confidence to keep going at it. And through the years, I got to play with them and get like a lot of stage experience and stuff. So I've been really lucky to have that.
I wonder in some ways, is it harder to play something really heartfelt and from inside you like that to a family member than it would be to do it in a more anonymous type of situation.
It can be. It depends on the song. Definitely.
So you're going to say it depends on the family member.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. No, both, maybe.
Now, you're in to talk or to tell us a little bit also about Ireland Music Week, which is a kind of a speed dating from you for music musicians and promoters and people in the industry. Explain what happens.
Yeah, so basically 50 artists come together from Ireland and about 150 to 200 delegates in the music industry from all over the world. Mm. And it's a whole week where you're just there to network with them and try and impress them and try and grow your team. So there's a few core bits to the festival, and one of them would be like the conferences. So they happen all throughout the week. And then also the speed dating with the delegates.
So is it speed dating with you and your guitar singing and playing a little bit, or is it just chatting about just what you might want, where you see things going and the kind of industry support that you're looking for?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you have 5 minutes with each delegate, and they might be, you know, the head of X label, the head of a publishing company, and et cetera. And you just have 5 minutes with them to pitch you, your story, and then maybe why you think they would be a good fit to work with you. And also the main part for me of the festival is the showcase itself, is the gig. So you just want to try and pull people to come to your gig, because then hopefully they'll book you for their festivals or, you know, to get involved from that. So yeah, it's a really, really amazing opportunity.
I'm guessing though, with that speed dating style pitch that you're talking about, you'd want to have thought through what it is you want to get from your career and from the various aspects of the people who are there, and also know a lot about what the style of the producer or the style of the publishing house that you're talking to. That's a lot of research and a lot of work that needs to be done.
A big spreadsheet there that I have with it, you know, but you can kind of select, if you know what you want, you know what you need, you can kind of select a few people that you're going to focus on throughout the week and try and get them to come to your gig. But yeah, it's a really amazing event.
All right. You are going to sing a second song, and this is from the first EP, Up Against Your Nature. Open-ended, you say that the songs on the first EP are even more personal. So what was open-ended that had you gone off to write a song?
It's a song about the process of healing. And it's about resilience and getting through tough times and moving into the summer. So it's kind of the opposite of the time of year that we are now, but it's called Open-Ended.
Open-Ended, let's have it then. Holly Monroe.
All about this spring mirage, the things I thought would kill me, surfacing like lily pads, the bruises of my guilt trip. Salty touch and slow to heal, but there's nothing like the feeling of showing up for yourself, 'cause you're the one that needs it. The things I thought would kill me, I've befriended nothing. Of healing for me, for you, it's open-ended. Done with feeling full of doubt, 'cause you can't trust being confident. There's no need to prove yourself, your power is your instinct. It's okay when nothing lands, it doesn't have to change you. Fall into your teardrops, 'cause water is what made you. The things I thought would kill me, I've befriended, nothing's ended. With thoughts of healing for me, for you, it's all. Thank you. spring mirage glowing from the inside. A little bit of self-belief, a blessing I had disguised. Coasting over feelings, am I being condescending? Nothing left to prove except learning how to mean it. The things I thought would kill me, I've befriended. Nothing's in me with thoughts of healing for me, for you. It's open-ended. The things I thought would kill me, I've befriended. Nothing's in me with thoughts of healing for me, for you. It's open-ended. For me, for you, it's open-ended.
Open-ended, the title of that song from Holly Monroe on her first EP called Up Against Your Nature, the second EP, a crescendo ending, and Holly accompanied this evening by Brendan McGlynn. That gig that Holly was talking to us about as part of Ireland Music Week that she wants the promoters to go to, and presumably you out there to go to as well, is on Thursday, October the 3rd at the Grand Social Loft, 10:30 p.m. You can find out full details of that and in fact everything happening as part of Ireland Music Week on irelandmusicweek.com. Sightless Cinema is a collaborative arts project for people with sight loss to devise and produce audio theatre. Started in Dublin in 2015, has expanded to two other counties since. Their audio dramas are presented in cinema settings with full surround sound, sometimes recorded, sometimes performed live. Home, their latest production, is on tour this month, playing at the Civic Theatre in Tallaght, as well as the Dunamaze Arts Centre in Portlaoise, the Solstice Arts Centre in Navan. It's a collection of six short dramas, three recorded, three plays performed live. With me in studio this evening, founder and director of Sightless Cinema, Ciarán Taylor, and Bernie Kelly, who is a member of the Tallaght Sightless Cinema Group. Just explain, Ciarán, because I mean, we've spoken about this before, and just the idea of how it works on the night you go to a sightless cinema, either as a sightless person or as a fully sighted person, it will work for any member of any community.
Yeah, that's it. That's the idea, is that blind and sighted can experience it together without any need for mediation. Because, you know, generally if people are blind, go to the cinema, they need audio description. So in this case, it's cinema with no pictures. So the audience who are sighted are offered a blindfold, and most people will take that. And then the plays and the stories are presented in surround sound. So it's using the cinema sound system, but without the pictures. So you really feel like you're in the middle of the story. You know, it's all happening around you. The sounds are coming from behind you and the side and so on, and the characters are sort of moving sonically around you, you know. So so it's great in that it can be shared, and then afterwards obviously all the pictures are sort of imagined, you know. It's a bit like reading a book. You imagine the stories, you imagine the characters, so people have lots to talk about afterwards, you know, comparing how they experienced imagined. It you know
well there's a sense of the radio play about it, but that being in the cinema, I suppose the communal experience of that with the surround sound, and for a sighted person but on a blindfold, you will obviously hear and feel things, experience things totally differently. But let me go to Bernie. How did you become involved in Sightless Cinema in the first place, Bernie?
I got a phone call from Ciarán.
So you were beaten into it, were you?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about those early experiences and what it did for you in terms of just simply experiencing stories in this way.
Well, it's given me confidence in speaking, and I've made a humongous amount of friends now. And it's so exciting going every week and not knowing what, when you go upstairs into the recording room, what you're going to do.
So it's a weekly meeting, Ciarán, then, is it? And do you record loads of stuff that will never see the light of day?
Yeah, we do. We do lots of improvising. So the stories are all created from the people who are involved. And it might be based on a true story. Mm. Like, so we've one play called Sleep in the programme, which was based on one woman's experience of a sleep clinic. You know, where you go to a hospital and try and get a night's sleep and they monitor you and so on.
Yeah.
And she got no sleep at all because there was noise coming from everywhere. And we've taken that true story. We improvised with it and sort of dialed it up. So there's like sleepwalkers and people, you know, having night terrors. And all sorts of mad things happening in that night. So yeah, it happens over a long time. Like, we developed the program over about 9 months. Yeah, we'll write up the scripts then based upon the stories. The characters are invented for the people who are going to play them, and then the people in the group, then we record with them over a number of months. And
yeah. You're involved, Bernie, in a production called Homeward Bound, and this is one of the recorded pieces, so it's already done and dusted. Tell me a little bit about the story of Homeward Bound and the character you play, Lisa.
The character I play, Lisa. Is
she's married to Oisín, isn't
she? Oh, she's married to Oisín.
Who's a bit of an Aegis.
No, and home. This is Homeward Bound one.
We're each in two different plays.
So Homeward Bound is the one we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, my character is I'm leaving home because the family is struggling, so I have to leave home to raise funds to work. Far away.
And that means she's a Dublin woman, this Lisa character.
Yeah.
And she has to perish the thought, go outside beyond the pale.
Yeah.
And she's going to find that very difficult. Mm-hmm. She is. All right. Let's have a listen to the clip, which features yourself, Bernie, as Lisa. And Anya is the other character here. Who's
Played by Sinead.
Sinead.
Yeah.
Right. Well, here we go. We'll have a listen to the conversation between the two women.
Who ordered the scone?
That's me.
Just let me know if you want anything else.
Thank you.
Looks like a nice scone.
It's what I'd miss about here. Do they even do scones in Tipperary?
Of course they do scones in Tipperary.
Well, how would I know that, Lisa? I've only spent about 10 minutes in the place. It's very different, that's all.
If you don't want to go, don't go.
If only it were that easy.
But it is easy. I've spent my whole life not going places.
Frankie has his heart set, you know. I think deep down, he never really settled in Dublin.
But that's not your problem.
Well, that's what marriage is. Give and take, isn't it?
Anya, you're a city girl since you were 16, and you're a city girl now. Tell him you want to stay. Dublin is where all your friends are.
And there we go. Sinead McDonough as Anya and Lisa, played by Bernie Kelly. And this is part of Sightless Cinema's upcoming tour of 6 productions, 3 of them pre-recorded, 3 of them live. And with me in studio this evening, Ciarán Taylor of Sightless Cinema and Bernie Kelly, who you just heard performing for us there. When it's done like that, Bernie, and it's pre-recorded and it's played, the pressure is off you. But there are also live shows where you're standing up with the live audience in front of you. How nerve-wracking are they?
Well, we're actually seated.
There you go.
On stage.
You have a little bit of
ease
in that respect.
Yeah.
But you're working, obviously the lines have to be learned, the character has to be known, and there are all of these sound effects going on around you as well. How difficult is it?
Well, when we done In the Dark.
Which was another one of the plays, yeah.
Was another one of the plays. The way we try to, like, it can be recorded, it can be braille, large print, which I do the large print because I can't read braille.
Right, so it depends on the nature of the level of sightedness that the person has. Yes. That's how they work off the script. And I believe, and I have to be careful how I say this, I believe you have been married to several members of the Sightless Cinema group.
Oh, yes.
You might explain how and why before we have lots of phone calls asking us, how did she do that?
Well, it's just in the different characters, because there's only 3 women in the group, 4 women in the group. It goes by the play. If it's an older woman, it's one of the other ladies. But if it's a younger woman, it's myself or Sinead. But I think it's because two of the men, we just seem to bounce off each other. We have the personality to bounce off each other.
So you have been married your characters have been married to some of their characters in the process. I'm wondering about that live performance, Ciarán, you know, because the old style radio plays, sometimes when you see those radio plays performed and you see the sound effects actually happening in front of you, is that part of the experience of the live performance, that you see the Foley artists, as they're called, who are making these sound effects?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at that stage, some audience members will take the blindfold off because there is something to watch, which is, so the guys in the cast, like Bernie and the others, will be making sound effects live, but it is that old-fashioned Foley things. So when somebody comes through a door, we have like a half door that is opened, you know, on stage, and, you know, if somebody's walking on gravel, they're walking on gravel, or, you know, they're clinking with glasses. So it, like the people making sound effects, the timing is very precise. So it's a lot of practice in that then. So obviously they're learning their lines in different ways, depending on the ability. Some are using computers, some recording, some braille and so on. But then when they get together, we have to like really rehearse the timing, and the sound effects are part of that. So it's very rhythmical. But it is great fun to watch, actually, you know, if you take the blindfold off.
I would imagine. So just finally, if you would, Bernie, I love the story of Numbers Game, which is the live performance that you'll be involved in. What is the story behind the play?
The story behind the play is my husband losing his lottery ticket.
One of your several husbands.
Yes.
in the group. Your husband losing his lottery ticket.
Yes.
And they've spent a fortune in the pub celebrating the win.
He's promised everybody in this village
that they'll get a chunk of the money.
Yes.
So don't go to the pub the night you win the lotto is the lesson there. Listen, thanks to both of you for coming in. In terms of the touring aspect, how important is it for you, Ciarán, to get the whole sightless cinema activity out beyond, as it was, just Dublin?
Yeah, I know, it's great. We've expanded recently into Meath and Laois, and we're hoping to expand further into the country because, you know, I think it's very important for the visibility of, you know, people who are blind to show that they can contribute to the cultural landscape. And also, you know, take over the theatre. There's going to be 28 blind people on stage at this show, you know, and they put on a great show. And our audiences have been growing over the years. Like, we finished up our last tour, we had 200 people in Port Laois on a Tuesday night. So people, when they come, they really get it, you know. Yeah. So it's great to you know, give visibility to people with disabilities and show, look, we can create something that's really fun.
We are differently abled rather than anything else. Thanks for coming in, Ciarán Taylor, and indeed Bernie Kelly.
Thanks. Correct you there. My name is Kenny.
Kenny, I do beg your pardon. Bernie Kenny and me calling you some other name all night. Anyway, Bernie Kenny is the woman who has been in with us this evening. And that is our lot for tonight. Home from Sightless Cinema is performing at the Civic Theatre in Talla on the 14th of October. Solstice Arts Centre in Navan on the 16th of October. And the Dunamuse Arts Centre in Port Laois on the 17th of October. Tonight's programme research was by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.